You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Just got off the phone with the chef. He won't join us this week. He's in the hospital. The chef suffers from congestive heart failure. So keep him in your thoughts and prayers. He sounded good. So hopefully he will go get treated for that and then be out and about. So anyway, time for us to get Grant Newsham on. So stand by.
Yeah, good morning, Grant here.
Grant Newsham. Where in the world are you, Grant Newsham?
Oh, just Tokyo.
Just Tokyo. All right. Mm. So, it's always important to establish that fact. I'd be remiss today, 18 years after the attacks in Manhattan. What goes through your head 18 years later, Grant?
Oh, boy. The Redskins still haven't won the Super Bowl. But beyond that, like everybody, remember it. I was, at the time, what was working for Morgan Stanley in Japan, and we had about 2,500 people in both of the World Trade Center towers put together. And so we had expected when they went down to have lost most of them, but it turns out that only maybe 7 or 8 were lost, and the rest got out, and that was owing to a fellow named Rick Riscorla, who was the head of security for Morgan Stanley at the World Trade Center. And Rick Riscorla, despite the building orders for everyone to stay put, he had everybody get out, because he had sort of expected something like this at some point. And he has the kind of guy with the forcefulness, the persona that got people to do what he said. And he is the guy, and his team are the ones who got most of those people out. The ones who were lost, a number of them were his guys and him as well, because he went back in. And you knew he would, to make sure. He's an interesting guy. He was, he's from Cornwall in England, but, was an American. And he was with the U.S. Army in Vietnam. And if you read Hal Moore's book about the Yadrang Valley battle, right. We were soldiers once and young.
Right, right, right.
Read that. Rick features prominently in there because he was a lieutenant. And I think you could make a case that if it were not for him, the Americans would not have held. And it's worth reading, even just the parts where he's mentioned, because he had that thing about him. And there's some other American officer who says that something like, you know, man, Riscorla was singing Cornish war songs. He wasn't scared. Why should I be? And is quite a guy. You know, you met him and you knew he had that magic.
Right.
But so that's one of the things. That's what I think. You know, I hope people remember him at Morgan Stanley. I don't know. But it's funny, you know, but he says you knew he was going to go back in. So when they told me they couldn't get a hold of him, I was pretty sure what had happened. But that's what I think of. Also, the other thing that came to mind when I watched the towers go down, you know, horrified, of course, was almost a sense that, well, you know, I did tell some people that they needed to be in the U.S. government, that they needed to be more careful and do things differently, or they wouldn't be able to prevent things like this. And I wasn't the only one, but that was the other thing. So that's what I think. It's hard to imagine that it's 18 years, but I did want to mention Rick Riscorla. R-E-S-C-O-R-L-A. It's worth looking into. Very interesting guy. He was he made charlatans uncomfortable.
The spell that again. R-E-S.
C-O-R-L-A.
Rick Ristorla.
Richard Ristorla. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The no, it's just you look back 18 years later. I was, I said earlier, I was out of the Marine Corps, and you know, I was doing broadcasting, and you know, I ultimately will come back in the Marine Corps. I think because of that exposure, both my sons become Marines. That would not, right, be the case otherwise. So not only did it change my life, ultimately, you know, I'll do this in as I retire from the Marine Corps, and the efforts that I've made relative to post-combat related mental health with post-traumatic winning that, if you can believe the grant, I don't know that you and I have ever talked about this, but this part of what I do, but 2nd Marine Division was having 1.2 suicides a month when I went to deliver what is the body of knowledge that I've learned from this culture of ours, this incredible, crazy culture of the Marine Corps, and how it deals with the aftermath of trauma. And since I've done that, I've been back 3 times to do it with units that were deployed, with new joins and whatnot. In 9 months, they've had 1 suicide. And that would never have happened, you know, were it not for this. My younger son met his fiance while he was in the Marine Corps, so his life would not be changed. Would change in the way it's been changed. So it's just, you look back, you know, over the course of 18 years, you know, all the good and the bad that has come from it. And it's just a huge event in American history, and not only American history, but it also spawned the war in Iraq. And then it went on to spawn the broader conflict in Afghanistan, which we find ourselves, low all these years later, still involved in both of them. So a pretty gigantic day in American history, and it's reverberated around the globe for 18 years. And a lot of innocent people have died because of it. And as I said, as America has both done good and bad in the aftermath. So it's a huge day. It's certainly a day that will live in infamy along with Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I think so.
What about, before we talk about, I want to play some audio for you. But before I do that, I want to ask you, John Bolton resigned. What now, in particular, with Afghanistan? These talks with the Taliban have been called off, which the president is wont to do, only to turn them back on, which I think everybody expects will happen at some point. But what now with Afghanistan? Much consternation that he's trying to, you know, cut and run like President Obama did in Iraq so that he can say, I ended the war and I got us out. I brought us home with our troops home with pride, mission accomplished, although nobody uses that phrase anymore. And then just in time for the next election cycle. So what now in Afghanistan? What do we do? Where do we go?
I don't know. The first thing is, I just as a sheer curiosity would like to know who it is in the Trump administration who set up this meeting at Camp David. They should be escorted out of the White House under armed guard. I can't think of a reason for doing that. It is just so astonishingly stupid that one hardly knows what to say.
So why stupid? I portray it as stupid in the context of the Taliban. The quote-unquote Taliban is a loose confederation of leaders, sometimes acting in concert, sometimes not, depending on what is their personal motivation to sustain their own power, both physical power in terms of arms and economic power. Thinking that they can act in concert, I think, is folly. The other thing I have to say about that is they will make any deal they can with the United States to get the United States out of the country. None of it is binding on them because a deal with the infidel has no legal standing in their world. And so they won't be bound by any of it. So I think it is absolutely a joke. I'm curious, when you say is, what comes to mind in your head?
Well, you've laid out two of them. You know, when one hears the Taliban, as you said, there's probably 200, 300, 400 Taliban leaders who could make some claim to having some power to negotiate on behalf of some part of the Taliban. And if Pakistan's ISI, their intelligence service, isn't in the room, that has no meaning at all. They're the ones behind the Taliban, of course. So you've laid out some of the main concerns, and plus the optics of it are just horrific. You know, to have them meet shortly before 9/11. You know, this was the Al Qaeda and Bin Laden were allowed to operate and plan on in Afghanistan with the support of the Taliban, the support and the protection of the Taliban. Admittedly, sometimes to sort of sort out a conflict, you do have to put people you don't like into a room to agree to something. But there's, once again, the optics of this. You could have done it, in the Red Roof Inn over in Anacostia if you wanted.
or you could have gone to Iceland to do it. I mean, come on.
You could do it anywhere. Plus, these guys, they'll agree to anything. And they must think that, they wouldn't want to come because they suspected a trap, that not even the Americans could be this stupid. This really is just a ridiculous thing. Additionally, look at the way this deal has been negotiated without the involvement of the government of Afghanistan. That alone is just crazy. The Taliban depicts the Afghan government as puppets, and here you have the Americans operating negotiating with the Taliban to reach an agreement of some sort, and then they go tell the Afghan government, a.k.a. their puppets, what they've negotiated on their behalf without telling them what they are negotiating. It really just defies imagination, this administration has generally, I think, been good on foreign affairs, but this one is just baffling.
I'm curious about your opinion about this. What it smacks up to me, and Bolton's exit to me echoes the same thing, and that is this: that he wants out of Afghanistan, and he's looking for a way out. The Taliban are doing their best to give him one. Right. And nobody's under any illusion. So the sequence of events, as you are rightly articulated, right, is an agreement with the United States, right, to get out of the way. And then we'll deal with JROA, the federal government of Afghanistan. Now, you've already characterized them as illegitimate. You've told people not to vote in the next elections for the puppet government. And now you're going in some way, shape, or form to deal with them in some fair way. Who believes that? And so to me, it's almost like the president is rushing for the exit and, we'll declare victory. We'll bring the troops home with honor. We may or may not have a parade because that doesn't work out very well most of the time. And then we'll be on to the next event. It seems like, and then to me, Bolton's exit would be, cue the band, because he's not going to sign up for that. John Bolton knows that that's ridiculous. And so that's what when I look into my crystal ball, that's what I see. Your thoughts on that?
I really have no idea about the internal workings of the Trump administration, sort of the Byzantine infighting that goes on. So I just have no idea, who thinks what and who did what for what reason on this. In terms of, as you mentioned at the beginning, what to do about Afghanistan, I would suggest the place is not worth $45 billion a year that could be spent, say, maybe buying anti-ship missiles for the Navy that go as far as the Chinese anti-ship missiles go. There's lots of things you could do, but it is a place where you can sort of keep a lid on things with a minimal investment of the right mix of military and economic support. all with the objective of turning the place back into what it was when my hippie brother went through there in 1973, when it was a pretty good place. But, that is sort of what I would do if asked, if I was invited to Camp David to give my advice. That's what I would recommend. But I, this is a troubling one. And John Bolton was a very good, he was smart. And he was also, I think he was having him in the broom. I've heard some people mention, refer to him as something of a fail-safe. He was not a yes man. And I think having him in any president's room would have been a good thing to have. So I'm, as much as I understand the situation, I think it's unfortunate that he's left. But I don't know, exactly as I said, I don't know why or what's going on in terms of the knife fight that is a part of personnel movements in every administration.
Interesting. All right, I want to play for you a little bit of audio. It's about 3 minutes of audio. And let me just, first of all, let me make sure that you can hear this, okay? So tell me if you can hear this.
How would you like it if you left the top position in the administration?
Okay, can you hear that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is Neil Cavuto, a guy named Ken Fisher, who's a billionaire, I guess. And he has some very, very interesting things to say about China. And I want to play about 2 or 3 minutes of the audio, and I want to get your thoughts on it. So stand by. I'm going to approximate where I want it. And
the timing of Kim Jong-un's physical movements, remembering that Kim Jong-un never stepped foot out of North Korea from the time he became head of state until he hopped on the train in response to the tariffs against China. The fact is, Chairman Xi said, come here, little Kimmy, come here, I want to see
you. Do you think he's calling the shots here?
I absolutely believe that the relationship that exists, there's no reason for North Korea to exist as it does. This is a country with less paved road miles than a small town in America, in the whole country. This is a very poor place spending money on nuclear weapons.
To this trade thing.
It's China's ankle biter against America.
Well, will we have a deal before the election, do you think?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. Let me say that if I'm Trump, and I've said this to you before about other things, including the Mexico tariffs and what have you, sometimes Trump caves on a little agreement. Sometimes he waits for more later.
So there's
going
to
want something.
Ken Fisher sees a method to what he's doing. It's not just...
Trump told you when he wrote his book eons ago, you start off acting like a crazy man, you act big, they offer you a little, and you decide you want to settle for it. And sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. I can't predict President Trump. I don't try to. The fact of the matter is he's got something going on in his brain that he wants to accomplish. Will he?
But you almost make it sound like it's a little orchestrated. You wrote, memories are short. If Trump got his big win now on trade, you're talking about trade.
Oh, yeah.
Folks would forget it before the election.
Oh, yeah.
So he would have to stagger it to close to the election a year from now.
And if you get too close, he loses his power, too, because if you get too close, China then says, let's wait it out and see if he's still there. We don't lose much by waiting.
You think it's
a tricky function, but I revert to my point that fundamentally America is a country that takes things for granted. Once we get it, we assume it was always there and it's just on to the next. We're a kind of an impatient on to the next culture, and that's good and bad all in one. But the fact is that Trump, who is, despite all of his critics' criticisms, he's in things political, as you pointed out earlier in the show today. He's been very crafty in his 2016 election, pulling off something that no one had ever done before.
And he might be doing it again.
And he's always got some plan there. Whether it'll work or not, I don't know.
Well, he got odd praise, Ken, from George Soros, the billionaire investor, who likes his stance and thinks it's his greatest foreign policy achievement. He did warn, though, I think in the context of those remarks, don't cave on Huawei.
Think of China in this way. If you look at WeChat, their social media, can't sell it for beans outside of China. Look at the Chinese exports of other tech products. They're about this big. Alibaba outside of China staggers. Right. The fact of the matter is all of that comes because the China system is based on censoring. There's only one Chinese source of media that does not appear to be censored, which is Caixin, where I write monthly. I'm one of a handful of Westerners that write there. And the fact of the matter is that if you're going to have that control system, you really have a hard time selling on the outside. Look at the Chinese-originated semiconductor export market. It's tiny. In this world, semiconductors are to this world what steel and electricity were to the 19th century, maybe even steam. But the fact of the matter is, if you think about it, semiconductors are not new tech, but they're fundamental building blocks. They're the bricks that we make everything out of.
Are they in peril if we don't settle all this stuff?
As George Soros points out quite correctly, Huawei has tremendous difficulty if they can't buy American tech products.
Right.
We are stronger because we are America, the land of the free and the home of the brave.
All right. Now, there's a lot there, Grant, but I thought it was very interesting the way he kind of frames North Korea as a Chinese-sponsored boil on America's ass. I also found it very, very interesting is we look at China as this kind of monolithic economy, but he also points out the fragility of it, and later on he goes on to talk about currency manipulation and how that has always failed throughout economic history. Any thoughts on any of that?
Oh, yeah, that was an interesting sort of recording. The film is certainly worth listening to. I think he certainly describes Americans pretty well as impatient. One thing that we do tend to do is to forget what we did that got us into whatever mess it is. Sometimes introspection and then acting on that would be a good thing. So I would accept his observation in that regard. Regarding North Korea, I think that is the best way to consider it. It was hard to think of any other explanation of why Kim, just dropped everything and went to see Xi Jinping in China more than once. And that gives you some sense that when China snaps its fingers, that North Korea and its leader will listen and do what they tell them to. And I think that North Korea is being used to cause trouble for the United States, for Japan, and that suits China's purposes very well. It gets reported every now and then, and not as often as it should, that the Chinese have been behind North Korea's missile and nuclear developments as well. I think he characterizes that very well. Regarding China, what he said, it makes sense to me, and it's sort of in line with some observations, but he really gets to the lack of attractiveness of most things made in China, for safety reasons, it's just not very well made in some cases. The quality is not very good. And the, any food product, you'd be nuts to put that into your mouth. And ultimately it's not just the products, it's an unattractive system. It is based on, as he said, censorship or control, restraint, oppression. And that's, notice people are not lining up outside of Chinese consulates to get visas to go live in China, rather the reverse. And that is something, it's good to step back and look at the thing, at the country from that perspective and say, well, nobody really wants anything they have, other than perhaps Huawei phones, or the cheap stuff at Walmart, and nobody really cares where that's made. But he's onto something as well with the Chinese currency. That too, nobody wants it. That you cannot freely convert it. If you have a big bag of Chinese currency, it's almost like having Confederate money. And that too, if they ever really put their currency into the market so that the value was determined by demand, or lack of it, I think it would plummet in instantly if they did that, and I have a feeling that's why they don't do it. So he has a lot of interesting things to say there.
Why do you think the free nations, or let me ask you this, do you think that other nations will join this economic fight? Because to me, the United States maybe didn't want it to get where it's gotten, but anybody who, as you taught us here for the last couple of years, anybody who believes in truly believes in fair trade knows that the United States does have to stand up on its hind legs. And if you're going to do so, these are the things that have been on the table for decades that the Chinese have simply ignored. And the United States, and I love the way Grant phrases this, you can have a deal anytime you want. Just get on your knees and accept the Chinese terms. And that's what we've done. And so if you say that this needs to end, this needs to end, and this needs to end, and if you stick to that, what you're talking about is the fundamental destruction of the Chinese economic system. Now, that system's got to be modified unless the whole world tilts and China calls the shots. But if China's going to be integrated in the world of free economic trade that's done by free nations around the world, it has to be compelled to stop doing this. Now, the United States finds itself in this war, this economic war with the Chinese, in that the American economy is still doing fairly well. In fact, 2018, I just saw a number that said it was the highest, it was the greatest increase in disposable income in like 50 years in the country. So, I mean, the economic data continues to come in, continues to be positive for the United States. And so do you think other nations, is there a tipping point that you get to where the UK says, Great Britain says, you know what, we're in this too, and that Japan says we're in this three, that other nations, other economic powerhouses say, you know what, we don't like it either, and we need you to come to the table. Do you think at some point that happens? Because that either is going to happen or the Chinese continue to attempt to rewrite the rules of the economic road around the world.
I don't know if we know for – well, we certainly don't know for sure what's going to happen. I think you never do. Sort of guess would be that if America can actually keep at this sort of current policy that it has of playing tough with China economically and really trying to sort of reset things so that American businesses in particular start setting up their businesses, their supply chains, outside of China. It's sort of they use the expression decoupling or delinking from China, and it will never be 100%. But if you can get some substantial amount, that is to U.S. benefit and really benefit of the free world.
Right.
So the thing, if America can demonstrate that its policy is still helping American companies to make money while being less dependent on a China that has the rules set so that any company doing business in China will eventually go out of business, and that other countries, and I say the countries that matter, particularly the Europeans and the Canadas, Australias, the free countries, if they see that, then they too might grow some a backbone, grow some sort of courage in dealing with China and say, well, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to demand China play by the rules, or else it is not going to be so easy for Chinese interests and Chinese money to get into our countries, and vice versa. We're not going to make it easy for our countries' companies to go into China. So maybe if the U.S. can set the example, show that this is actually a sort of profitable way to order things with China, that other countries will go along. But I think it does require us to take the lead. And China is terrified. And not just of America, but really of the other major countries lining up with the United States against China. And that is really what scares them. So I think if a U.S. administration can continue this and a future administration, then I think we have a chance. I would just note that when the Trump administration began this approach, that I'm sure that they did think, well, what happens if China does not roll over and do exactly what we want? I do think they played it out more than a few moves, so they're not entirely winging it. But, of course, any time you do start a stricter trade regime against another country, that you never quite know how it's going to play out.
Right,
but
right.
So reasonably optimistic if America can stay the course. But it's going to take, this is going to be a multi-year struggle. But if we back down and just in exchange for a promise to return to how things were before 2016, in that case, I think we will have lost. And of course, economic power is ultimately political power.
Right.
And if a country is so inclined, it's military power as well. And if you're inclined to use the military power to bully and coerce, like China is, then it gets pretty scary if you play it out a bit.
Well, you know, if you extrapolate what you just said, the free nations of the world stand and say, no, these are the ground rules that we all play by, and we will stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder against you and tell you that you've got to come to the table, right, as a part of this. We are not going to bend to you. I mean, imagine what that means. You know, you've just defined and limited, right, Chinese expansion around the world simply because you've defined it economically. You are no longer, we aren't going to play this game where you steal people's technology. We won't participate in that anymore because it's fundamentally unfair, you know, just to have access to your, you know, the great demand that you hold inside of you. And so to me, it's this incredible strategic, it's this incredible strategic play that is the play, in my opinion. It's the play. You can talk about all the other stuff that you want to, but this is the play in terms of where does China fit. And if you fail here, then good luck to you, because you will fight this fight. You will fight the South China Sea. You will fight the Nine Dash Line. You will fight the Senkaku Islands all over this world with China as they roll over people, because you won't stand together. So I think it's interesting. So
certainly is that. You know, not to say I'm, if we can stick with it, I think we've got pretty good prospects. And I've mentioned this before, but it's really always worth keeping in mind, is that when China wants to do something overseas, you know, to fund the Belt and Road initiative,
yeah,
you know, say build something in some place, you know, to buy things, you know, the semiconductors they need, just anything they need to get, they have to pay in foreign currency, which is dollars, euros, maybe Japanese yen. And that's currency that somebody wants. And because China cannot just print its own money and then go, you know, to the money exchange in where New York and change it, because nobody wants it. So to spend a dollar overseas, China has to earn a dollar from overseas. And to the extent you can reduce the amount of money they are earning overseas, the less they have to fund all these things they do, the political initiatives, the buying up foreign companies, buying the things they need to build their military. And that is, the Trump administration has understood that, I believe, and that is, if you can reduce that, it makes things very difficult for the Chinese government. But it's often not, it's in all the commentary, you almost never hear that mentioned. There was a Chinese guy named Bo Xilai, who was basically done away with. He's in jail now, back in 2013, 14 or so. And he was a very popular rival to Xi Jinping, the current president of China. But so he was a real dog, demagogic, I think he even kind of believed Marxism. But he made a comment that really it's very helpful for understanding China's situation. He says, look, to buy a 737, a 737,
right,
we have to sell 20 million T-shirts. And the point being that unless China can export things and get paid in U.S. dollars or, you know, foreign convertible currency, It can't do all these things. It can't buy these things overseas. And that is just amazing how often that is forgotten. Just the commentariat seems to often just regard China as a really big Canada with a comparable economic and financial system. And so that's the thing that I've been stressing lately, that people do keep in mind that it's that vulnerability on the foreign currency front that, that China faces.
Talk to me. You wrote a piece on September 9th, Trump's foreign policy dash, taking America to the dentist. Can you explain the underlying premise of the article?
Yes. The underlying idea is that it's been obvious for a long time that China is a sort of a threat in every respect to us, militarily, economically, and more than anything else, it represents the really the force of oppression versus what the United States has, freedom. And it is this fundamental existential threat that we have going on. And really, this has been obvious. The military threat has been undeniable since at least 10 years ago, I would suggest 15 at a minimum, to anybody remotely observant and willing to admit reality. I would say that even 30 years ago, it was apparent that it didn't take too much imagination to see what was coming with China militarily. But, and I've used this expression before, is that instead of dealing with that threat and doing what's necessary to stop it or to be prepared to overcome it, America has instead preferred to take a shot of vodka or an aspirin the way a guy doesn't want to go to the dentist. You know, if you have to have your wisdom teeth removed, well, would you rather go do it, or would you rather put it off a little longer if you could just take a shot of something? And in the American business community's way of looking at it, well, if we do that, we can also keep making a lot of money for ourselves for some period of time. And so I just wrote an article based on the idea that America has avoided going to the dentist for all these years in doing what is necessary to deal with China. And I point out that Mr. Trump is the first guy to actually get America into the dentist chair. You know, obviously parts of America are sort of trying to wriggle out of the chair and squirming mightily. But that's what I'm giving Mr. Trump some credit for. And once again, it's a real estate man from Queens, not known as a foreign affairs scholar, and presumably did not do a semester abroad in Paris while in college, getting his international relations degree.
Or London.
So he's the guy that kind of got it right, you know, got America into the chair. Whether or not he can keep us there, I don't know, but you know, and I would note that even the military, U.S. military leadership, too much of it, did their bit to keep America out of the dentist chair. And you had really a ruling of the military top leadership that was keen on engaging with China, you know, getting to know them, exercising with them, having exchanges, bringing them onto our aircraft carriers, showing them everything. Making sure they get invited to the RIMPAC exercise. That was just too much of our ruling class that did that. And, you know, I would have to say that I think it was 2008 when the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, General Conway, visited the Chinese Marines in China and gave them a pep talk and pretty much told them, hey, you know, work hard, guys, and get good at your craft. Well, they did, unfortunately. And that really was pretty much typified how headquarters Marine Corps has done boneheaded things when it comes to Asia for just too long. This was horrifying at the time, but decisions get made wherever they get made, and I don't even think Marfor Pak was consulted about this. But as I say, the Marine Corps deserves some credit as well for having made sure America didn't get into the dentist chair and have the wisdom teeth removed. So that's what the story, the piece is about. And it's sort of half tongue-in-cheek, but it's also dead serious, is how I would put it.
Just the education, it almost, when you begin to pull the curtain back and you to see the reality of, for instance, we don't even talk. Rarely is it even mentioned, right? The issue of the Uyghurs in Western China, that they're in Muslims in concentration camps being, quote unquote, reeducated by the Chinese. That story is not a story that our media wants to talk about or tell. And, you know, so it's like you begin to pull the curtain back on this totalitarian state. And then you say, well, wait a minute. Why have we cozied up? Why is the Commandant of the Marine Corps giving pep talks to what do we think we can be with this country, right? That includes the nine. The nine-dash line is, you look at it, it has no basis in reality. It has no basis in anything. The claim to Taiwan, no basis in historical anything. And so it's like, I guess, and as Grant has told us, we can be friends. You just have to learn to sing The Emperor's New Clothes in a cappella. And as long as you keep humming those tunes, we can be friends. Okay? But if you want this relationship to be anything reciprocal, if you want it to be based on a rules-based order, and if you want it to be based on international law, that will never happen. So as long as you can put all that aside, so you confront that and you think, what could we have been thinking? Is our desire to have our companies sell into China so great that we would accept something so corrupt and so imbalanced? Is that what we did by staying out of the dentist chair? And the answer to that is, yeah, that's what we did. So it's like the dental work that you could have had would have been, you know, a filling or two. Now what we have to do is we have to reconstruct your mouth, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's about how it is.
It's amazing, though, Grant. I mean, how you willfully look the other way with all that shit. And I remember, this is funny, you'll laugh at this. When you first came on and started talking about things like the nine-dash line, I was like, well, I should read about this nine-dash thing, whatever he's talking about. So I looked up the nine-dash line. And looked at it. It's the stupidest shit you've ever heard in your life. Like, you know, there's a, what's the line, it's called the economic exclusion zone, right, off a nation. It's like, I believe it extends 200 miles where you claim territorial rights to the natural elements that exist, on the surface and subsurface, right? And so China's just like, yeah, we don't believe in that. And this line goes down the coast of Vietnam, over to Malaysia, up the Philippines. Yeah, this all belongs to us because we say it does. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was hard for me to believe. Like, how does nobody push back against this? So.
Yeah, this, as I said, this was obvious 10 years ago and 15 easily. And it really should, it was just willful ignorance or just overlooking this threat that was coming. And you know, I was in a position and to see a lot of people who should have known better getting us into this mess, and it's going to be lance corporals and sailors who pay the price, and a lot of civilians who had nothing to do with this. And I'm not optimistic about how this is going to play out. I think it is going to take, I think things are going to get rough. And we'll see. But it all could have been avoided. Just in the, you know, just give you a sense, and I'm just, you know, speaking from personal experience.
Right. Right.
Before the Dawn Blitz 13 exercise in Southern California, which was the first time the Japanese sent an amphibious unit over to America, or anywhere really, to train. I was quoted in a newspaper article. I said something very close to the following. If recent history has taught us anything, it's that when the free nations get together to defend themselves, it has a stabilizing effect. And the U.S. Marine Corps' courtier class went absolutely berserk. You know, this was supposedly provoking China. It was going to get Xi Jinping angry. What was I doing? You know, and dealing with that, it's no surprise where we are today and why China could defeat us in certain circumstances in Asia. So we're trying to dig ourselves out of this now, but that's what we were dealing with, and that was only 5 years ago, five or six. Another story that deserves mentioning. I sound like the history guy a little.
You do.
There was the head of intelligence at the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Was a fellow named Captain Jim Fennell, and he too, for years, he's studied the Chinese military for probably at least a couple decades longer, and for years he was telling anybody who would listen that the military buildup was intended for a short, sharp war, and that China has a plan to use it on a specific timeline. He was sounding the alarm. The Obama administration despised him, and they passed word to U.S. Navy that they didn't like him and they wanted rid of him, and he was effectively forced into retirement in 2015, for saying what he said, and there were senior Navy officials in Washington, in Hawaii, who went along with this and had their role in cashiering him. They've all gone on to bigger and better things, of course, but it was one of the most disgraceful events that I've ever seen, maybe in my lifetime. Not surprisingly, now it's very popular to be a China hawk, to be sounding the alarm, being a China skeptic sells. And yet, these people were the ones who thought Jim Fennell was just being just outrageous, and provocative. And now they all sound a lot like he did. Since some of the audience probably has a military background, I do want to make sure that. People do realize that the U.S. military could have done much better with a little introspection, some thought, and listening to a few people who'd studied the issues, that we've done our share to get ourselves into this mess, and I really am not sure how we're going to get out of it. Mostly because God gives the United States more chances than it deserves, but we've really gotten into a fix.
All right, I want to ask you about, get your thoughts on Hong Kong. The protesters in Hong Kong seem to be able to outcycle the authorities. There's been some really interesting technology that's been developed that they're using, which they can send messages phone to phone, and then my phone acts as a transmitter if you have this app and it's a general message or something like that. Very interesting technology. So we haven't seen a Tiananmen Square like event. The head of Hong Kong has quote unquote officially withdrawn the legislation about extradition, but that no longer is what this is about. This is now a bigger issue. Give me your thoughts on what you've seen in Hong Kong so far, and then get your crystal ball out. Where does it go? How long can China tolerate this?
Just a few questions. I saw the video of a crowd at a Hong Kong soccer match against between Hong Kong and Iran, and it had the audience singing their newly written Hong Kong national anthem, and you watch it and it's really moving. I think to see these people, and many of them younger, who just want nothing more than to be free. And they're standing up in the face of a really scary adversary. I think there's probably an entire generation in Hong Kong that isn't going to be sort of shifted back towards becoming sort of loyal subjects of Xi Jinping in China. That's just a very interesting thing. I think the psychological battle has probably been lost for the Chinese Communist Party. But it, as noted, it is such a formidable adversary. It's the equivalent of the Mongols pouring out of the steppes in the 13th century to go sack Krakow for the first time. It really is a sort of a scary thing. But to see these people standing up to it, you've really got to, it's moving for me. I think one of the reasons, what we are seeing, though, is I think the Chinese intelligence services, they've already started going to work in Hong Kong, trying to identify people who are sort of ringleaders. I don't even know if they care if they're ringleaders. I think once you make a few people disappear or arrest them and scare the daylights out of them and give them rough treatment, a word gets around. So they're sort of quiet intimidation approach. I think what has restrained them for now is that on October 1st, I think it is, the 70th anniversary of the communist takeover in China is going to be held. And if there were some sort of, if there was some real chaos or rough play in Hong Kong, that would really detract from this ceremony that the Chinese Communist Party is putting on I think October 1st. And they're stage managing it the way the North Koreans do one of their parades. You know, just it's over. You know, everything is over the top and goes with this scary clockwork, all intended to show just how splendid the Chinese Communist Party is. You know, so splendid that they won't let their own people have an election and choose who runs them. But that's restraining them when it comes to Hong Kong. You know, otherwise I think they'd have probably sent either the People's Armed Police or the military.
Grant, I'm losing you. It sounds like a microphone is moving or something, and it moved.
Okay. Well, I think after October 1st, that we may, the prospects of a sort of Chinese sending in either the police or the army or really cracking down hard.
The little green men, maybe?
Yeah, well, that could work. Or even just say, look, you know, this is Hong Kong is part of China. We'll send our forces anywhere we want. But there's something where they do, I think, more than they've done to now. But they want to get through, I think, the ceremony, the celebration on October 1st, and then the odds of something really violent taking place increase. The question is whether or not China is willing to accept the loss of Hong Kong as a financial center, and that could easily be the outcome of sort of a move towards violence by the communist regime. So, you know, it's probably just, you've got a respite probably of a month, maybe 2 months. And then after that, it's going to get pretty interesting, and I think it could get even rougher. But the people in Hong Kong are showing us what, you know, really what the free world should be doing, standing up for freedom. And ultimately, what you're seeing at work here is nothing more than a human desire for freedom that probably has existed since Fred Flintstone's day.
Is the threat that Hong Kong may no longer be the cash cow for mainland China that it is in terms of hard currency, is that probably the greatest concern? I mean, because, you know, the Chinese really don't give a shit what other people think. They know what they have to do. They know that people need to sell into China, and that whatever they would, you know, say, we are going to prohibit our own exports, from going into your country would be, if it happened, would be relatively short-lived, and most nations would vehemently protest, but at the end of the day, do nothing. Is their critical vulnerability the fact that Hong Kong, you know, businesses might move out of Hong Kong and you might see some other place in Asia? become the economic center?
I think that's part of it. But it's beyond just Hong Kong. You know, if you could somehow just isolate Hong Kong and, you know, make it disappear, you know, China would of course survive, but it would be the knock-on effect from that of cracking down in Hong Kong in a way that scares, not just scares people doing business in Hong Kong, but also makes even the people who, you know, want to make money in China and are willing to overlook anything, would present them with such clear evidence of the nature of the Chinese regime that they wouldn't want to do any business at all with China anyway. And I think that is maybe one of the bigger concerns, is the ripple effect dropping down on Hong Kong. And if they get that...
Okay, hold on. You went underwater again.
Okay, let's try again. You know, if Hong Kong is destroyed, you could find the ripple effects of, you know, of other, of people elsewhere not wanting to do business with China anywhere. So it could hurt the overall Chinese economy, their access to foreign exchange, the cumulative effect of many countries, many companies saying, well, we don't want to do business with this horrible regime. And that is what I think really scares them, is not just Hong Kong, but the right. ripple effect right. of cracking down there. And if you get enough of these countries and companies that take a stricter stance towards China, see it as no longer attractive or a place where they can be, even for moral reasons, say the cumulative effect on China's economy and foreign exchange earnings would be enough to give real pause to the people in Beijing. That, I think, is how I would tend to look at it. Not just Hong Kong. It's not as if that's the only place China gets money from, but the knock-on effects of violence in Hong Kong. That's what I would see as the bigger concern. And China has, this is not good publicity when you're threatening to crack down on people who say they want to be free, where you've got 3 million Uyghurs in, or Muslims in prison camps in East Turkestan or Western China or Western occupied China. When you have that, you know, it's not been a good run for the Chinese Communist Party lately. And as I've mentioned earlier, it's become to the United States for how long, I don't know, but becoming a China skeptic is now the in thing to be in right. that foreign policy class right. In Washington.
Well, you so know, let me tell you, do you remember the report the Hoover Institute released last year? I mean, it was stunning in mm-hmm. its, I don't want to say condemnation, but of its very stark warnings to the nation about China. And it was stunning to watch them roll that out. You know, you just saw... You know, General Mattis on his book tour talk about, you know, you had President Xi tell President Obama in the Rose Garden at a press conference that we will not militarize the islands in the South China Sea. And he said straight up lie. Let me read you an email, Grant, that you've kind of introduced the subject. Mac, I saw a week or two ago in the news that the Japanese had sent, and then in parentheses, maybe I heard it on your show, I think you did, the Japanese have sent their police to the Senkaku Islands. Could Grant comment on that? Grant?
I think actually what's happened so far is now they're talking about setting up a police unit that will respond to incidents in the south, in the Senkaku region, the Senkaku and that area. But they haven't actually, I think, got the organization in place nor sent it down there. But they understand the issue and what's needed. And that's what I think that's about, is that it's really in the thinking about it stage. And the way things tend to work kind of slowly in Japan, so it could be a while before they get anything down there or the ability to respond. I think it'd be a good thing if they were to get some sort of civilian presence down on the Senkakus. If you'd, once again, this is, If you're going to go to the dentist and have them do the work, you might as well have them do it. If you keep putting it off, they're going to wake up someday, and there's going to be Chinese on those islands and some others. And then it's going to take a lot more than police to deal with it. But, so it's in the thinking about it stage, but that's farther than they have come to date. So we'll see how that goes.
The final question, what are you writing next? What's next on the agenda? Well, first of all, what are you doing in Japan?
Oh, just just a few odds and ends. That's all. Nothing too strenuous. But a little bit sort of Japanese underworld related research.
Oh my God! Well, be careful. I want to ask you about. I think since the last time you were on, the United States announced the sale of what, F-16s to Taiwan.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. that's true.
Not an insignificant event in the world order. What is the significance of that in Taiwan?
It's a sign that the Americans are showing more support for the Taiwan government. It is worth noting that John Bolton, who just left, was considered a big supporter of support for Taiwan. Once again, there's a psychological aspect to this sort of deal, but it does give certainly improves the Taiwan Air Force capability. Obviously, in a high-end war, eventually you'll run out of them. But before that, it's useful to have better equipment, and they'll put it to good use. But one thing to keep in mind with this is that even though America has sold the F-16s, or is going to, it still refuses to train with the Taiwan military. I'll say that again. It still refuses to train with the Taiwan military. So selling them hardware is one thing, but it'd be a whole lot more useful if the U.S. forces would just even do anything to help the Taiwan military break out of its isolation. And until we do that, then I'm not as impressed with hardware sales as I otherwise would be. But I think that is the key to everything, is to stop treating them as if they have leprosy and to start doing things with them. Start with HADR operations involving both of our amphibious forces. But that's the real prerequisite. So I think the F-16 sales, and I think that's nice and overdue, but unless we're actually going to let them come out and play baseball with us, the benefits of this will not be nearly what they otherwise could be.
All right. What's next coming out of your pen?
One of these days I want to get that, since Robert Mugabe has departed, the long-term dictator who ruined Zimbabwe, I've had a piece in the works for at least 15 years on this basic subject of how the Western elites, aided and abetted by some Asian countries, have tolerated guys like Mugabe for far longer than they should have, and they ought to be ashamed. So that's what I'm hoping to finally get done. I think 15 years is about normal for how long it takes me to get around to most things. So,
All right. Tell everybody where they can find your work, Grant.
Asia Times, The National Interest, and a new magazine. It's called And Magazine, A-N-D. Magazine. A friend of mine is the publisher, and it produces some very good things, and I write for them as well. And so those places, and sort of here and there, if you type me into Google, you'll find my name more than you would have. I don't make any money, of course, but I am at least my name shows up more in Google if you type it in. And you'll see there's a bunch of stuff I've written.
All right. There you have it. Grant, first of all, always fun to catch up. And thank you very much for the visit. And be careful writing about the Yakuza. Is that how you say it?
Well, that'll work. Yeah, they know what you just called them.
All right. Well, be careful writing about them, and all the best.
Okay, now I'm going back to sleep. So nice to talk to you.
All right, thanks, Grant.
Right, sir. Mm-hmm. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. That is Grant Newsham here. Always, again, always fascinating to talk. Email. Mac, what was up with this microphone? I don't know. He must have got a new microphone. It sounded like he was moving it. And so anyway. All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll finish things up. And on the 18th anniversary, the 18th commemoration of the events of September 11th in this country and the shockwave that it set off, and those events still unfolding around the world. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.